The Barrett family Lego franchise is expanding. Tesla is on the verge of entering the S&P 500, and we have a question for you. What's in your index? Welcome to the Ultimate Crowdsource Personal Finance Show. This is your Friday Roundup.
You're listening to Choose FI Radio. The blueprint for financial independence lives here. If you're looking to unlock the secrets to financial independence and early retirement, you're in the right place. Stay tuned and join a community of like-minded people who are getting off the hamster wheel and taking control of their lives in the pursuit of financial independence. Choose FI, your home for financial independence online.
All right, guys, super excited to dive into this week's episode. To help me with this, I have my co-host Brad here with me today. How you doing, buddy?
Hey, Jonathan, I am doing quite well. Yeah, what's going on in your world?
Well, I have so many great things going on, so much to tell you. But honestly, I need to find out more. I'm going to kick it back to you because I want to find out more about this Barrett family Lego adventure. I heard your kids are becoming Lego moguls.
Well, yeah, that's certainly one way of looking at it. So during this quarantine, they have been loving Legos. And I think I might have mentioned this a little bit on the podcast, but just in case I didn't give the full story, I'll try to explain it here. So this is not let's get Legos and build the Millennium Falcon or the Empire State Building or something like that. This is they're getting these little Lego figurines. Like there are these very special, like, I don't know, Lego friends, I think they're called. So anyway, Molly and Anna have pretty much devised an entire world of like 100+ characters. So I kid you not, they have 100+ of these Lego friends. They have an entire genealogy for them. They have different intonations on how these characters speak. They have different events at their like mock swim meets. I mean, Jonathan, it's incredible, like this fantasy world that they've devised. But naturally, they've actually spent a decent bit of money trying to buy some of these items. And, you know, in fairness, this is their money. As I've talked about before on the podcast, we give them an allowance and they save at least 50% of it. They put a certain amount to charity and they put a certain amount to spending. And that spending is unfettered as far as we're concerned. We have no veto power. Laura and I have no veto power over it. That's the point of teaching kids about money, right? And they have taken pretty much every single dollar of their spending money and bought many of these Lego friends dolls on eBay. And it's been a cool, besides the fact that they've gotten hundreds of hours of entertainment out of this, they've actually looked into this almost akin to like a business, Jonathan. They've learned a lot about the marketplace on when you sell and buy, really buy in their case, when you buy different lots of these, there are different prices per unit. So if you buy a lot of 50 Lego Friends dolls, sometimes you can get them for $1 or $2 each. But sometimes if you buy five of them, they might be $4 or $5 each. And it varies, obviously, depending on the particular dolls that are included in these. You know, there's some scarcity factor. There's all these factors that go into, just like any marketplace, right? Like what determines the value of something? And it's been really cool to see them sit there and really go through hundreds and hundreds of different eBay listings to try to determine what do we want? What's the best price? How can we get these particular Lego friends for this price? So I know I'm kind of rambling here and it's eventually going to talk to the business aspect of it because they brought into that. But has what I said made sense so far?
Yeah, I mean, I think I need to ask a couple clarifying questions as I try to perform some forensics on this this business model, you know, so I can replicate it in my own zip code. So up to this point, the kids have an interest building worlds with Legos. That interest in building worlds, apparently building worlds is profitable. Elon's talking about building a new world on Mars for all of us. So we'll come back to that. But anyways, building worlds with Legos, assigning these Legos names and characters. But really up to this point, that's what they've been doing. Now, all of that interest, those hundreds of hours have made them very familiar with the disparity, the gap between prices per units in some, you know, when you purchase them in some lots and prices per units when you buy them in bulk. There's a huge gap. And they find themselves shopping and paying a lot of money for the one or twos, you know, buying one or two units at a time. And they're saying, oh, when you buy 50 at a time, there's a huge gap between the two. Is that, am I caught up to this point?
Yeah, that is the perfect summation of it, Jonathan.
So they've learned all about market inefficiency at this point.
They absolutely have. And what really was this point of inflection for them was when they found a lot of like 200 or 300 of these dolls in one point. It was a Goodwill, I think in Missouri or Minnesota or some such, was selling, and they didn't even specify how many it was. It was just a picture of a large pile of these things, essentially. And Anna figured out just by eyeballing it, it has to be easily 200 or 300 of them. And they wound up selling for basically $1 per doll here. And Anna was trying to do the math on, okay, I think I could probably sell these for $3 or $4 each if I sold them in the right lot. So anyway, unfortunately, they did not win that particular eBay listing. They actually were trying to do it just to make a business out of it. So it was cool seeing these little seeds form, right? And what that then did was, the next step was, they realized they had excess of these dolls just lying around. They weren't using them. They weren't part of that roughly 100 character world that they had devised. So they wanted to try listing and selling on their own. So they determined 10 was the exact number that they would put into one of these lots. They had 20 of them. So they had two different listings for sale. And that was it. They had no extra accessories or anything like that. They just listed 10 dolls, 10 in another, and put them up on eBay. And really, it was as simple as that. eBay even gives you kind of a rough estimated price that they would advise you start with, and some even additional language around what you're listing, et cetera. Evidently, there's some scarcity with like elves and boys. So it's hilarious. So they were so excited, Jonathan, so excited. And they listed it. The listing goes for 7 days, and they had people watching. You could see the page views go up. And it came time, you know, usually the bids come in the last 30 minutes, usually the last minute or two. And we're watching, we're so excited. It was like a party at our house. And the clock ticked down to zero. And there were no bids on either of them.
Oh, I thought the story was going to end differently. No, this is good. Okay. All right. This is life. All right. How did they pick themselves up? So they created the listing. They tried to create scarcity. They did copywriting. They had it priced at a certain level. It seemed that people were interested. They come to the end. And nothing.
Total crickets. And man, you could have heard a pin drop in our house. I mean, they were, you know, they were shocked.
Were
they
you
really
cursing
were.
Just Lego customers everywhere? Like, what's, don't you know what's going on here? The life lessons that I'm trying to teach?
Well, I have to say, not only was I not cursing them, I was thrilled. This, in my opinion, was the best case scenario, the absolute best case. So there was no crying. There was no stomping around the house. They were disappointed. There's no question about it. But we immediately turned it to, all right, we've learned some lessons here. What have we learned? Let's try to figure this out after the fact. Like, what did we do wrong? What could the possible factors be? My kids have, by most measures, had a pretty easy life. And I want adversity for them. So I was thrilled with this, Jonathan. I wasn't like gleefully bounding through the house, but like secretly inside, I was gleefully bounding through the house and having these conversations with them. What could have went wrong? So we looked at other listings that sold. You know, some of them included all these other accessories that maybe the pictures weren't as good. I don't think we did a great job with the pictures. Maybe honestly, the listing time was just bad. This was over the July 4th weekend, and that was for many people, even during times of COVID, July 3rd through July 6th, Friday through Monday, are not the greatest times to be going on eBay, right? So, you know, there were certainly some other things we chatted about, which I'll probably think of in the next couple of minutes, but those were the ones that jumped out, right? Like, was the pricing wrong? Did we just simply get the pricing wrong? Maybe we should have started it at $1 or $2, and when you start to see people bidding, then it becomes this feeding frenzy, right? I've noticed that on eBay certainly too. And maybe that was an option. So all these things, and the girls had to consider them. And it was cool seeing the two of them huddle there. And it wasn't Laura and I involved in it after that initial conversation, but they were huddled trying to figure out, all right, what do we do next? They were looking around their room of Legos, trying to decide, like, are there accessories that we don't care about anymore that maybe we can throw in? They're worthless to us. Let's throw them in. they created better pictures. You should have seen the symmetry and the color that they included in these, the way they lined up these accessories. And the one thing I don't think they changed terribly was the pricing, though. I think they dropped it by about 10% to start with. And I am very, very happy to report that within 48 hours of those new listings, they got two bids on the one and they have one bid on the other one. So they are guaranteed to sell now. So we still have a couple days left. Probably by the time this podcast goes live, they'll have sold finally. But man, isn't that cool? It's just such a learning lesson encapsulated in this tiny little experiment.
There's so much here. You know, we were talking about it from the perspective of kids. Wow. Like for you to be able to have those conversations, how do you work through failure? And, you know, what do you learn from that? Success is built on failure. So if you just shelter your kids from failure, what are they going to learn this as an adult? It's going to be so difficult. Why would we do that to them? I love that. And then actually now let's get super mercenary and talk about it to adults real quick. Couple big lessons that I've personally have learned over time. One, what sort of crazy person bids on eBay ahead of the last 5 minutes? Why would you do that? I'm just saying, I'm glad your kids have a bid right now. But for our listeners, I'm trying to provide value. You don't bid on eBay until the last 5 minutes of the, you can buy it now anytime. But if you're trying to bid on eBay, why would you do that to yourself? Wait till the last 5 minutes and then you put your bid in. Or there's like a couple apps out there that are called like eBay Sniper. It does all this for you. And you basically put in the bid that you know you're going to want. And then it'll submit it for you in the last 2 to 3 seconds of the thing. Like I'm just saying, people, this is technology. You're just projecting out there, you know, what the real market value is. If you put it 3 or 4 days ago, you're giving someone else who is already using this strategy the chance to come in the last 2 to 3 seconds when you're going to miss it and not be here. So that's one. Two, I know, right? I'm just trying to throw value at you. That's two right here.
That's good.
I have lost lots of eBay competitions, but not recently. Lastly, all right, homeowners. There are so many first-time home buyers and first-time home sellers on the market. And you don't learn this until after you've screwed it up and you don't get a mulligan on that sale. And so what I'm about to tell you is going to be very valuable. You can also talk to an agent. You do not want your home to hit the market right before July 4th. If you want to ride the momentum and get those bids in there, because like with the home market, it's the opposite. You want to get that bid in as quickly as possible if it's a house that you love. And conversely, a house that doesn't have any offers the first week, yeah, you probably are going to get bids, but you don't have that hot streak that you do the first 24 to 48 hours. So you don't want to leave that to chance that you're going to list your house on a holiday weekend when everybody, the market's 40% of the market's not interested. They've decided to take it off. They're just doing stuff with family. And then you would have been able to get a bidding war, but now you're a weekend and someone's like, oh, what's wrong with that house? It didn't get any, it's not, no offers on it yet. No one's going to check it out. You're going to lose your hot streak. So I'm just saying this, that actually did happen to my house. I learned this the hard way. And it wasn't totally our fault. We listed at the beginning of June. We had someone have it under contract. They were 2 to 3 weeks in and then they backed out of the contract. Now I'm forced to relist going in July 4th. To be honest with you, I wish I had just kept it off the market and then gone back in the week after July 4th. I think it cost me $5,000 to $10,000. I really do. A little bit bitter about it, but you know, lesson learned. And here as an audience, you know, you talk to your real estate agent, we'll know about this sort of thing. But I mean, it was the momentum, the wind got sucked out of our listing sales when it went in July 4th. It was shocking to me. So this is how what you learn as a kid translates into real life.
Yeah. No, there's something to that, right? I mean, humans are a social animal. And when you look at a house, and this happened on our block, I think in the last year or so, essentially every single house on the street that has went for sale has been under contract within 48 to 72 hours. And then there was this one house that just lingered there for months. And it was absolutely inexplicable. And, you know, instead of me looking for data or asking questions of real estate agents or whatever it was, I just said, oh, there must be something wrong with it. And isn't that the common lament? There must be something wrong with it if every other person didn't want it, right? Like, and that's just so stupid. That is such a cognitive bias that like I fell prey to for no reason whatsoever. And it looked like it was priced right. It looked like a nice house. The pictures look great. But again, my only thought was there must be something wrong with it. And you see that with these eBay auctions too. Like and this is anecdotal, obviously. I'm not an expert. I'm sure there are many eBay experts in the audience. But from what I've seen anecdotally, when you start getting a couple bids, that's when you almost invariably see it ratchet up to 8 bids, 12 bids, 16 bids. People just keep, they don't want to lose out, right? And then they also realize, wow, somebody else wants this. It must be desirable. Coming back to, we are social animals. So it is so interesting how that works. And yeah, Jonathan, I mean, clearly the huge takeaway from this entire thing in terms of dollar figures for most people listening is clearly not selling Legos in eBay. It's timing is important. It's almost counterintuitive that like you want to sell when there's a lot of competition, but it's you want to sell when there are lots of people out buying. So it's usually, at least here in Richmond, it's usually in March and April. Sure, there are lots of houses on the market, but man, are there so many people looking to buy. Whereas, interestingly enough, like if you went to sell during December, I think that's pretty much the worst possible time to sell historically here. There might only be a couple houses for sale, but even still, your house is probably going to just languish on that market. And then you get idiots like me saying, oh, I wonder what's wrong with it.
It's been
it,
on
right?
the market for 3 months. I'm going to lowball them. I think they're hungry. I'm going to do 30% less than asking price. Just see what comes back. They don't have anybody else that's interested. This, you don't want to be on the other side of that. You don't want to be there.
No, you don't. Right? And you also say like, oh, they must be desperate. Right? Like why else would you list a house?
I will
in
wait for years. Don't you dare try to hit me with a 30% low ball.
But no, it's a fascinating conversation. It really is.
The thing that also popped out to me, just the lessons that your kids are learning that like as adults, we need to still learn. And as a parent looking for a way to help your kids figure out a side hustle, we talked about it in passing, but it's this price per unit inefficiency in the market. There are multi-million dollar businesses that are built every single year around that observation. This is a tried and true business model. It can be scaled anywhere. I'll give you one example just from our show on the most humble thing you can imagine. Sonny Burns talked about how when he was at the hospital, there was a pacifier for his kid that his kid loved. He couldn't find it anywhere. We'll have the episode number for you linked up, but just as an observation, he couldn't find them on Amazon to buy like one or two pack, but he found that he could buy 250 of them for like 10 cents a passy.
Pennies
like
on the pacifier?
Pennies on the pacifier. I was trying not to go there, but you forced my hand. And he's like, dude, I need this. If I need this, maybe other people are looking for this. Bought a big old 250 pack of them, broke them up, sold them for like 45 cents to a dollar a passy. He was making at the time, redonkulous margin. Redonkulous, that's a scientific term for a lot. He was making margin on these pacifiers. And eventually the market caught up to him. And he had some competition who realized what was happening and doing something similar, which cut into his margin. But his margin was so good to begin with that it's still a source of income for him and his family. And he built a whole system around it. That's a one tiny example. I mean, you can do this very, very easily. And it's just it's a game. You could look, let's just start noticing these inefficiencies. Wow, if I bought it in bulk, I could just look how much I would save. And then just start looking for that and just see, is there a side hustle? And this doesn't need to be a $1 million thing, because what you're really doing is you're cultivating the skill set of making the observations and then learning how, if you make even a few dollars on it, you've probably learned some valuable lessons about what to do and what not to do. Right, Brad?
Yeah, for sure. And that's really what the entire, I know there are many tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of people who are using FBA, right? Fulfillment by Amazon. And this is just simple, as you're describing, it's just simple arbitrage. You're looking for inefficiencies. You're looking for prices on products that are significantly lower than what you can turn around and sell it for on another marketplace. And it's pretty hard to source the items. There are certainly people with ability and skills and different stores that they can find. That's the hard part. But once you've found that, it's just simply, if you can find something that you can buy, purchase, and then turn around and sell for a higher price, including all the fees. And that's what a lot of people get caught up on, right? They don't realize how many fees are embedded in this. But if you can make a profit, like Sonny did, I mean, what a bizarre example in the cosmic scheme of things, but it doesn't matter what it is. That's the beauty. If there's a way to do this and make a profit margin, like you said, eventually the market caught up. Eventually the market almost always catches up to inefficiencies. But in the short term, your insider knowledge, right? The knowledge that you've gleaned from, in this case, him literally being in a hospital with his child, you can take advantage of that. So be on the lookout for those. These opportunities abound. They really do.
You know, we talked about world building at the beginning of this, and we were joking about Elon Musk you know, he is the CEO of Tesla, and his companies, plural, just seem to be taking off like rocket ships, and pun absolutely intended there. But what's interesting in particular about Tesla is that it is about to meet the criteria to be included in the S&P 500. And there are some criteria, which Brad, if you could look up for me, maybe we could give an accurate rundown of what those are. But the company has to be profitable, which has been Tesla's biggest hang up to this point, and have successive quarters of that. Obviously, it's a very valuable company from a cap weight perspective and a valuation perspective, but profitability has always been, I think, what's kept it out. And now it seems to be stringing together successive quarters of profit. And that's really interesting because the S&P 500 is 500 companies. So I think that means that a company's going to fall out, which is actually kind of interesting. And then two, on top of that, it kind of sets us up for a conversation about what's in your index, right? Like what does it mean that you own an index? Because not all indexes are the same. And when you say you own the total stock market index or the S&P 500 index fund, what are you actually owning or holding? I think that's kind of a fun place to spend some time. Brad, can you, before we do that, can you confirm what is the criteria to be included in the S&P 500?
Yeah, Jonathan, this was actually really interesting to look into. And it's actually done. So S&P is actually Standard and Poor's. That's important to note. So it's a company, a rating agency. So they actually have a committee that decides what companies are included in this S&P 500. And it includes 500, or roughly 500, as I learned, of the largest, but not necessarily the 500 largest. That was actually a misconception that I had. I just thought it was straight the 500 largest, okay? And what they're looking at in terms of what makes a company large is actually its market capitalization. So that is essentially the total value of its shares that are traded. So let's say a company has 1 million shares. This is a terrible example, but just a small dollar figure example. Let's say a company has 1 million shares. Each share goes for $10. You just multiply those. Okay. It's the dollar per share times the total.
Oh, I can do
shares.
This one. 10 million.
I thought you might. Good job, Jonathan.
Thank you, Brad. Good.
All right. So that is the market cap for that very, very small company. Now, obviously, that particular company with a $10 million market cap would not even be close to the S&P 500. It seems like roughly, based on what I'm reading here online, as of the S&P's guidance in February of 2019, so albeit this is about a year and a half ago, the market cap has to be at least $8.2 billion. So that would just squeak you into this list. Okay. But at least, again, this is done by committee and they select these companies. So the market cap has to be significant. Evidently, it has to be headquartered in the US. At least 250,000 shares trade in each of the previous 6 months. So it needs to be liquid. It needs to be something that people are purchasing at least a year since its initial public offering, its IPO. And interestingly, the sum of the previous four quarters of earnings must be positive, as well as the most recent quarter. So a company that we may have all heard of that is running losses, but still has a big market cap because people believe in it, that would not be eligible for inclusion in the S&P 500. So yeah, Jonathan, this is actually a kind of a cool exercise to look into what merits inclusion in this S&P.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting because if you think about it, like there's a lot of us that just buy an index fund. So, you know, the S&P 500 or VTSAX, and there's some implications when a company suddenly gets added to that index. So for instance, I just use Tesla just because, you know, it's a fun stock and you hear people talk about it. It's a water cooler stock for sure. It's in the culture. And if it's about to be added, suddenly if you were buying an S&P 500 index fund, suddenly your contributions toward that index would be purchasing a piece of Tesla. What's kind of cool about that idea is that I think it's so boring, and I love that it's boring. So it's not a slight, it's just reality. It's so boring purchasing index funds that we kind of forget that what we're actually owning is just a very easy way of owning the economy. So the S&P 500, it's largely just America's, the largest companies in America. If you own the total stock market index fund, which is actually the one that I personally invest in. So if you were to go to Vanguard, their mutual fund version is called VTSAX. Their ETF is called VTI. It's an exchange traded fund that tracks that index. That actually owns all publicly traded companies inside the United States, which I think, Brad, is right around 3,100 and 120 to 150, somewhere in that range. I wanted to say 126, but I'm sure it's changed since I came up with that number.
Jonathan, I actually Googled this just a minute ago, so it's funny that you brought it up. So yeah, I just Googled VTI Vanguard and VTSAX Vanguard, and they both have the same number. It's 3,493.
Oh, it's so growing actually, in popularity.
Yeah. No. Yeah. Who knew?
All right. So that's interesting because since VTSAX does not have all the same criteria that we just mentioned for the S&P 500, you just need to be a publicly traded company inside the United States. Then if you own VTSAX, you are already purchasing a company like Tesla. And this is where it gets interesting because not all indexes are exactly the same. The end result over time largely ends up being the same, ends up being very close to the same. But they're not identical. For instance, we just said the S&P 500, it's 500 companies. VTSAX, there's 3,000 plus companies, 3,400 some odd companies. If you were to be purchasing an index like the Dow or the NASDAQ, like that's a different index that's tracking different companies. And so what's in your index kind of becomes an important question to ask. And if you truly just want to keep it simple and just say own them all, arrange them by market cap, work your way down. So if it's a really big company, I own more of it. If it's a really small company, I own less of it. That's where VTSEX or the ETF, VTI, or now in this case, we've tried to go out of our way to say this isn't really about Vanguard's platform as much as it is about just the concept. If you want to own all the publicly traded companies, then there will be an analog at Schwab, at Fidelity, at, you know, most large brokerage institutions that do the same thing, a total stock market index fund.
Yeah, and Jonathan, it has been reported that Tesla, in all likelihood, there is a high likelihood, let's say, that Tesla is going to be included in the S&P 500. And yeah, as we were looking this up, it was kind of interesting to note that I think we saw that about 2% of the S&P 500 kind of changes each calendar year. So let's say 10 or so, plus or minus a year. So maybe on average, one a month. I don't know if the S&P is actually holding their meetings and really booting one company a month on average, but it seems as if it's about 10 or so per year, which is kind of fascinating. And I'm sure there are significant implications for those companies just by being included and not by virtue of being included in these indices.
You know, what you've brought up is a great place for us to deflect and kick down the road because we won't be able to speak to it with any real, like, significant intelligence at this point. We'll have to do some research, but even better than that, we need to bring on a subject matter expert. But actually, what you just said, there's two big questions, and it's all about having the questions. You can always go get the answers later, but having the questions, what happens when a company falls out of the index? What does that mean for their bottom line? What does it mean for their financials? What does it change the actual value of their stock? Because now people that were purchasing their stock with their dollar cost averaging contributions now aren't doing that. And also, you think about it, the indexes go both ways. So we were talking about what do you got to do to make it inside of the large cap. There are actually small cap indexes that Paul Merriman advocates for. What does it mean when you become a big cap, right? Like you just graduated out of small cap. You're worth too much. And so you're getting kicked out. What does that do to the index in general? These are types of the questions that when you're just thinking, all right, let me just keep it simple. You know, you don't really, and you don't have to know this. You could just go buy a total stock market index fund and you could just ride that peaceful wave to the finish line. It's great. That's what I do. But I still kind of want to know. And so what I was thinking we could do, Brad, is we could stack just a couple of these kind of advanced technical questions, which are still really good to know and make for great conversation. Great conversation. And we could maybe get Rick Ferry to come back on the show. And what I was thinking, there's like three questions. What happens when a company falls out of the index? What does that mean? What does it mean when a company goes into the index? And then the one that's also interesting to me is and he talked about this in passing when he was joining us on the show, the advantages and the disadvantages of ETFs versus mutual funds. So I just mentioned in passing that you could get VTI or VTSAX. They are two analogs of the same index. So the ETF version or this mutual fund version. And he actually said, I've heard him reference in the past that there are some tax efficiencies for both. And there's reasons to have one or the other, advantages and disadvantages. And I'd love to just kind of spend 20, 30 minutes there. Let's not kid ourselves. It'll be 45. But and just kind of pick his brain on ETFs versus mutual funds. I actually have kind of gone all in more recently on the ETF version. So like now in my taxable accounts, and I use M1 Finance, I've talked about that for that. I purchased the ETF VTI, which is an analog, a mirror image, an ETF mirror image of the mutual fund that we call VTSAX. And I love the fact that I can buy fractional shares. I love the fact that you don't need any like lower minimum amount. Like VTSEX, when you go on the Vanguard platform, it has a minimum threshold of $3,000 and some change to get started. I mean, I think it's just $3,000. VTI, well, on the M1 platform, just get started. And you can do fractional shares. It's just, it's crazy how simple they actually make it. It's my new default method for investing. But my knowledge is of the advantages and disadvantages of ETFs and mutual funds don't go too much farther than that. Like for instance, mutual funds trade kind of once a day. VTI is kind of fluid. You know, I have like one or two more small nuggets of information, but that's kind of it. And it's just, you know, your knowledge can build.
Yeah. And I think that's a great idea to get Rick on for sure to talk through that. That would be really, really valuable for us and for the audience, certainly. And yeah, it's interesting. We actually had a question on Facebook that I just pulled up from Ashish. And he asked, how do I check the price of an index fund, a mutual fund? In this case, he asked VTSAX during trading hours. Mm. That actually fits in perfectly here with this conversation. And mutual funds have their price is updated just one time per day, and you actually cannot trade them intraday. So that price, I guess they look at the net asset value of all the component parts at the end of the day. So it's after the trading day is done for the major stock exchanges, and then the price is updated at the end of that day. So you can't, not that we advise this, obviously, Jonathan, but you can't panic sell in the middle of a day if you have mutual funds. It's just you're kind of pot committed at that point until that the end of that day. So contrast that with, again, in this example, we are using Vanguard, but you know, we are not giving investment advice here, Jonathan. Obviously, we're not talking specifically about people investing in these funds. We're just using them as examples. But if you had VTSAX versus VTI, which is that ETF, you can get a price update at any point during that trading day. And you can also buy and sell at that point as well. So that seems to be probably for most people a benefit to ETFs. Now, obviously, it's a detriment if you're going to emotionally panic sell or panic, or maybe not panic purchase, but
panic purchase. Purchase.
Yeah, purchase with overt enthusiasm.
There you go.
But I think that's actually probably the answer, is because it is such, VTI is such a close analog to VTSAX. If you wanted to get a sense, not of the price of VTSAX, but of what percentage it is going to go up or down in a given day, or what it is at that exact moment, you would look at VTI. And now naturally, like we said, this is just but one example. There is certainly every major fund company has S&P 500, total stock market index fund, both mutual funds and ETFs. So you can use this concept for essentially any one of them.
Yeah, the one thing about ETFs, especially if you're purchasing them on the Vanguard platform, and I've referenced this, but I think it's important to note, is when you purchase an ETF, historically, you always had to purchase in whole share amounts. So like, for instance, let's say VTI was trading at $150, and I don't actually know what the trading price is, but let's just assume that that's what it was. $150 a share or $155 a share. In order for you to purchase a share of VTI, you would need to be able to pay or contribute that $155. If you had $200, then that means that you'd be able to purchase one share, and your $55 or $50 would sit on the sidelines until you were able to save up another $155. And so the downside was your inefficiency. Your money is on the sidelines for longer. But because of these incredible tools that are out there now, M1 Finance being really at the forefront of this, that has entirely shifted, where now you can purchase fractional shares of an ETF. I mean, this is really advanced, amazing stuff, and they've made it so easy. So if you have $172, you can purchase up to 1/100th increments of a share on the M1 Finance platform, allowing you to get every single dollar working for you. You can purchase a fractional share of VTI. And now I believe, because this has been so popular, because M1 Finance has surged, like just absolutely gone crazy, surging through how millennials, my generation, is investing. It's become one of the most popular, and I understand why. You're actually seeing old traditional brokerages who were really wanting to hold you to that 100. You need to buy one share at a time. That's what you do. they're bending on that. And I think Schwab, Brad, I think you were telling me Schwab's just recently rolled out fractional shares. And I think maybe even a couple of the others are now as well. But this is really important and it changes how far your investments go.
Yeah, that is true. I definitely sent that over to you. I think they're calling them Schwab stock slices. So I'm not sure. I'm not 100% sure. I need to look into this. If they can do this on mutual funds or ETFs, I guess, in this case. But it's definitely individual stocks. And I'm at their site right now. And it says the stocks available for purchase through Schwab stock slices are those, interestingly enough, in the S&P 500 index, Jonathan.
Oh, wow.
So yeah, isn't that funny that we were just talking about that? So it seems like they can do that in, it looks like the minimum for a single transaction is $5. So you can buy $5 slices of any of those S&P 500 companies. So yeah, that's super interesting. We're not necessarily advocating by any means that buying individual stocks, but you know, if that's your thing, that's pretty darn cool to be able to invest in $5 increments, because many of these stocks, Amazon and the like, can be significant. They can be four figures plus. And that's really, really difficult for a lot of people to buy even just one single share.
Yeah. To our audience, you keep hearing me mention M1 Finance. I promise you, I'm just going to keep mentioning it more and more. They are absolutely deserving of this attention, and it's changing investing. And you're really at the forefront of this. This is a technological revolution, just the same way that in the past we were dealing with paper stocks and all these crazy stuff. It's all gone. M1 Finance is just streamlining. It has never been easier to get your money working for you and become an owner of the economy. I've put together a review article with video tutorials to show you how it all works. For more information, go to choosify.com/M1. Choosify.com/M1. So Brad, I know, I feel like anytime we start talking about VTSAX and index funds, like what is going on in the background in my mind is the Simple Path to Wealth. And that's timely because I believe we actually have some big takeaways from the live you recently did with JL Collins.
Yeah, we had a phenomenal live event with JL a couple weeks ago. So yeah, we had JL 2 weeks ago. We had Brandon, the Mad Scientist, this past Saturday, the 11th. And we actually have Liz from Frugalwoods coming up tomorrow, the 18th. So we've had a star-studded lineup here, which is incredible.
I'm going to miss this summer live series, dude. You've made this a really fun event for the community.
Thanks, man. Yeah, I've really, really enjoyed it. And it was cool. It was funny, actually. We had that episode a couple of weeks ago about my prior former debilitating fear of public speaking, right? And we actually had, I think we had 6,000 views of that JL Collins Facebook Live during the live. So there were 6,000 people. I mean, that's a small to mid-sized arena, which is just crazy. We've had, I think, almost 20,000 views of that just the first week or so, which is crazy for a Facebook Live. So, I mean, people are just craving this information from JL. I know historically his original episode here at Choose of I is one of our most downloaded episodes. He is a wealth of information, and man, did he bring it, especially in this time of uncertainty, right? In this time of COVID and the quarantine and just people potentially freaking out. You know, he's just so soothing. I think just by his very nature, his voice, I know it's silly. You know, you shouldn't judge a book by its cover, obviously, but there is clearly a whole lot of substance there. But man, just even his very voice is soothing.
And it's funny, Brad, as you're saying that, I bet someone's like, well, I'm freaking out now. How do I watch that live? We got you. It's available. You can watch the replay. A lot of people already have. You can watch the replay as well. Maybe you can replay the replay. If you want to do that, just go to choosefi.com/live. But there's more. Honestly, this information is so important. It's so integral to what we actually talk about on the show and clearly timely to what we're talking about in this episode. We just thought, why create friction? Let's just play just a few clips from that live for you right now. So Brad, I know you picked out just a couple pieces that were particularly impactful. What are we going to talk about today?
Yeah, so the one we're going to play right now is an 8-minute segment of this live event where we talk about what an investor should do in these COVID times. And yeah, our team did an amazing job of taking that 90 plus minute live and actually breaking them up into 7 distinct videos that you can really dive into. So if you're interested in watching those videos, head over to choosefi.com/234. So that's this episode title, choosefi.com/234. And you can see all 7 of the videos. But here is the third one on what an investor should do in these COVID times. Yeah. since the beginning of March, JL. It seems, you know, obviously the world has intervened and the markets have been crazy and a lot of people are fearful. They don't know if they should be changing things. They frankly don't know. They're fearful and they would look to you to just hear what's on your mind. Since February, since March, how have you been thinking through this? Has anything changed? Have you made any moves? Have you made any adjustments? Just talk us through what your mindset has been like for the last 3.5-4 months.
Well, I've made a couple minor moves that the market created opportunities for that we can get into, but they're minor in that it's nothing that changes the basic philosophy. So right now, well, of course, now the market's bounced back pretty strongly, but for a time there, we were in the process of a market crash, and that's a normal thing. I mean, market crashes happen on a fairly regular basis. Fortunately, not very often, but we get 10% corrections on a regular basis. We get 20% bear markets on a little less, but still regular basis. And every now and again, like we did a couple months ago now, we get a crash. That is a normal part of the stock market. Now, the only thing that was not normal is what triggers the crash. And every time it's something different, I kind of knew something was coming simply because it had been a long time. I never would have predicted or tried to predict when it was coming. And I certainly wouldn't have tried to predict what would trigger it. I think it's tragic that what's triggering it is costing lives with the COVID virus, but something always comes along. Then the market recovers and goes on to new heights. So from that point of view, from the market point of view, nothing has changed. In the midst of the plunge, I was writing much more frequently than I usually do because of this topic. And there were a lot of comments on my Twitter feed and on my blog posts from people who are saying, well, this time it's different. And of course, that's what everybody says with every market crash is this time it's different. And I sort of tongue in cheek put a tweet up at the time saying I've discovered a new symptom of COVID-19, clairvoyance, because everybody seemed to know what the market was going to do, which of course was to continue to plunge. And as we know now, the market did the very opposite. Some wag once said, the market will always do whatever it takes to embarrass the most people.
I might have to quote you on that one. But yeah, Brad summarized that question right. Like, what were your philosophy? Because everyone's wondering, you know, should we stay in BTSAX, should we move to something else? And then
my philosophy, Jen, in a nutshell is nobody can time the market. Nobody can predict when these things are going to stop or when they're going to turn around, when they're going to get better. So the time to invest is when you have money to invest. If you happen to be lucky enough to invest when the market's crashing, then that's a blessing. I mean, I tell especially young people, like, you know, there's nothing more favorable to you than a nice solid market crash that brings prices down. When my daughter, you know, my daughter puts in money every month, like clockwork, which is what you should do. Mm-hmm. And she saves 50% of her income, as I recommend. And I noticed in April, I think it was, that set amount of money in April bought 19% more shares of VTSAX than in March. That's a blessing. So instead of being scared by market drops, you should welcome them. You should take advantage of them. You should certainly keep investing during them because the market will always turn around and it'll always go back up. Now, if you happen to be retired and living on your portfolio, then at that point you have bonds in your portfolio and the bonds are what you use to smooth the ride. But for people like my daughter who are still working and investing, this drop has been a bonus.
I would be curious to ask about reassessing risk tolerance. So for someone who maybe they've been investing for the last 10 years, things have been going swimmingly well. And, you know, maybe mid-March into April was the first time that they've experienced that 20, 30% drop. And maybe they didn't sell. They listened to you and they didn't panic sell and didn't lock in that scenario. But they're realizing, hey, maybe I'm not cut out for this like I thought I was. What would you say to a person who came to you with that? How would you, I guess, try to talk to them about long-term, but also if they truly did realize something about themselves and they wanted to make moves, how would they even go about that?
Well, that's a great question. So if you're invested in stocks and you find yourself in a sudden plunging market And it turns out that it is far more uncomfortable for you than you figured it would be. I guess my first piece of advice would be to stay the course till you get through this market cycle. And unless civilization ends, unless the U.S. economy ends, unless publicly traded stocks go away, we will get through this cycle and go on to new highs. But you've learned something important about yourself. And by the way, there's nothing wrong with learning that psychologically you're not comfortable investing in stocks. That's a very important bit of self-knowledge, as the philosophers say, know thyself. There's a guest post on my blog from a couple of years ago written by a guy named Steve, and he doesn't invest in stocks. He invests solely in cash. He doesn't want to deal with volatility of stocks. And I absolutely respect that, and I put his investing approach up on my blog for that reason. You don't have to invest in stocks. I think it's the most powerful thing you can invest in, but it's certainly one of the most volatile. And if that volatility keeps you awake at night and you can't adjust to it, then it's good that you know yourself, and there's no shame in that. And there's probably, you probably ought to be looking at something else.
Yeah, and know thyself. It's important. And Allison, Jen popped this across the screen before. She said it's better to dollar cost average than to be paralyzed by fear and not invest at all. And I think no matter what our opinions are, again, knowing yourself is really important. And frankly, JL, dollar cost averaging is something that I do. And I know it's not optimal. I know it's not. But for my wife and I, it's just something that is easier psychologically for us.
For just a couple of moments ago, I said the very thing, that
if
you are psychologically uncomfortable investing the lump sum, mm-hmm. you know, understand that you are adapting the math to your psychology, and that's not optimal. But as Allison said, if it's that or not invest at all, then I agree with Allison.
Yep.
And if that's the way you're comfortable investing, Brad, and you're certainly, you know the math as well as I do, that's a choice that you make.
It's great, Brad. And you know what I heard is stay the course. Stay the course. Get out of your own way when it comes to the short-term mindset and stay the course. This is a blip on a radar. And there over time, there's lots of blips. They happen. But you can't worry about the what's going to happen in the next 2 months, what's going to happen in the next 8 months. When you start thinking about things in terms of 10, 20-year timelines, would you rather have your money invested right now or 20 or 30 years from now? Do you want to wait 20 years to be investing? If the answer to that is no, follow your plan. And I can say comfortably, that is my mindset. That is actually what I do. And I don't really worry about the day-to-day fluctuations of the market or even the month-to-month fluctuations.
Yeah, I agree. I think that is the biggest recipe for long-term success. And yeah, just a huge thank you to JL, as always, for being such a treasured and really valuable source of wisdom. So yeah, it was wonderful.
All right, so let's go ahead and switch gears, dip into our mailbag. MK is on the show with us today. How you doing, MK?
Hey, I'm doing great. Feeling good. And yeah, just excited to be here for another week.
So we announced on the show that you're pregnant and you have an expecting date for later this year. How are things going?
Pretty good. Yeah. So I'm in the second trimester. So I have that second trimester energy where now I want to do all the things before the baby gets here. Like I'm releasing another book. And I was like, Jason, I think I should launch a course. And he was like, why don't you try to finish everything on your to-do list before you add more. So he's talking me off the to-do list ledge, as it were.
Well, I heard one of the things on your to-do list is you're putting together the audiobook for Doug and Carol's book, Financial Independence for the Next Generation. How's that going?
It's going really well. So first of all, Doug has a great voice. So we were just talking about how JL has a very soothing voice. Doug also has a great voice, as does Carol. So it's really nice to go through. And I've read the book several times, obviously during the editing process. So now to get to hear it, it's really coming together well. And we're going to actually have bonus content that will only be available on the audiobook when it's done. So I'm really excited for that aspect because I know, obviously, our podcast listeners like to listen to things. So maybe they would want the audiobook. So we're working to get that released as quickly as we can for pre-order as well. So stay tuned for updates there.
All right. I think we have some mailbag wins. I just wanted to find out what's going on in the community.
Well, we've got a few updates. So we were talking a lot several weeks ago about the Simple Startup Digital Summer Camp that Rob Phelan was launching with us as part of the Simple Startup coursework and associated workbooks that we published through Chooseify Publishing. And it's going really well, but the students actually need feedback now. So they're doing their market research. So just like Brad was talking about earlier, how Molly and Anna had these very real life, you know, oh, well, this didn't work. What do we do? What do we try next? So the students who are in this digital summer camp are looking for feedback. So if you actually want to help, maybe you thought, oh, I wish I had that when I was younger and I can't participate now, boo, you can still participate. You can help with the market research. So if you head over to facebook.com/thesimplestartup, all one word, that's the Facebook group for the entire content for the camp, for the books, for everything. So he's posting the surveys that the students are putting out for market research there. So you can help them launch their business and know that you are helping the next generation become entrepreneurs. You'll help these next big businesses that may or may not one day make it to the S&P 500. I'm bringing it all back, guys.
Wow. No, I like it. Can I wrap some more string around that real quick? Tie that up.
When do you ever not, Jonathan? Go for it.
Brad, let's be realistic. It is actually my job. but it's from a place of sincere interest. We actually had a lot of people. So that both camps sold out. There was some limited capacity just because there's the live component to this. And this was our first year piloting this. But we had a lot of people actually message us saying, can I still do it? Is there a way for me to sign my... And now with this fall, like school is just, who knows? Like really, in any zip code, the teachers don't know, the students don't know, the administrators don't know, who knows? But what we do know is we would love for our kids to start building out this skill set if they have free time. Is there any thoughts behind the scenes with the team to like somehow figure out a way to make this a year-round camp where you can sign up whenever you want, just that's your day zero? Any like anything behind the scenes there?
Absolutely. So that has been part of the discussion. When we launched the first camp, we were like, we'll see if anybody wants to sign up. And then it sold out really quickly. And we were like, oh, okay, we got to get going. There's a demand here. So there is some discussions around that and figuring out. So Rob is still a full-time teacher as well. So he will be going back to school in some capacity in the fall, whether it's digital or in person. So we're trying to figure out how the live component where the students can actually ask questions and get feedback would work. So once we sort that out, we will absolutely be coming out with more information on how students can participate in the Simple Startup year long. So stay tuned for that. We will obviously let you know as soon as we have information on it.
All right. So we've been sitting on the best question of the week, the biggest, the greatest question of the week for our mailbag conversation today. What do you got for us?
Well, there was quite a bit of a question that came up over the weekend, and I need to issue a public apology for making a certain listener's ears bleed. Ooh. Because apparently there is a debate over whether the title of this podcast and brand is Choose Fi or Choose Fi.
Yeah.
And so I say Choose Fi. I don't know. I'm a city girl.
Purist.
I just like to, you know, run all my vowels together. But some people say Choose Fi versus Choose Fi. So there was a discussion over that. It seems like the consensus was, it's interchangeable. We know what it means. Right. We know what we're talking about. But that was kind of a fun conversation. And one thing I did realize is there is a third potential pronunciation, but nobody would ever use that.
Don't introduce that it. Don't introduce it. Don't add the kind of comment.
Yeah, but nobody listening to this podcast would actually choose fees. So
I'm going to bleep it out.
Work.
They won't be able to hear it. I'm going to go back and bleep it out.
You
won't
think
know.
I'm saying something else.
B5FO. That's funny.
This really was a funny one. And yeah, David, the exact wording that he used was Choose Fi or Choose Fi, one syllable. What do you say? My eardrums almost started bleeding when I heard MK say it as one syllable in the public speaking episode. And, you know, I have to say this is, it's hilarious because I think we do each have our own pronunciation. Like Jonathan, you and I, for whatever reason, have always called it Choose Fi. And that's just how we refer to the podcast. And MK, I have to say, like, when I hear you say Choose Fi, like, while my eardrums do not bleed by any means, because I think I would have stopped you by that point, I'm like, oh, that's interesting. I guess
does
people
a little
say
piece of you die every time you hear it? Is that, what I feel like you're saying?
I mean, no, that's a little exaggerated. But
I live on the edge of a little exaggeration, Brad, at all times. That's where I stay perpetually.
But to each his own, obviously. But yeah, I definitely call it the actual podcast. I call it Choose Fi.
When Brad and I started this, I came to Brad with a brand name for this idea in mind. I presented him after kind of doing some brainstorming and writing everything down on paper. I said, Brad, the name will be. And I had to work through what I was going to call. And what it basically came down to is I had more fun saying choose FI out loud. Mm-hmm. It just came down to that. Like, I felt like I couldn't get away with, all right, welcome to choose FI. Like, I just couldn't have as much fun with the extra syllable. So I made a very intentional choice personally when I was presenting the brand name to Brad to really lean on the welcome to choose FI. You know, you see that there's a difference there. You can have more time with the syllables. And as a podcaster that leans on the, you know, that kind of resonance, that's how the choice was made internally. But I just want you to know, David, and to the audience that, yeah, that sat with me too. I was like, well, people know how to spell it also. Like, what's choose FI? Like, if I say FI, I'm like, oh, I'm embedding in there where to go find it. So, but we had to work through that. And I was like, you know, over time, people will just forget it. And they'll just, because we keep saying it this way, they'll just say it that way. But then MK joined us and she just blew all that up. So thank you for continuing the controversy, MK.
You're welcome.
Doing your part.
That's what I'm here for, apparently. Just all the controversy.
Oh, man. That's
all
great.
Right. Well, now that we have solved this question, this situation, we can all go enjoy our weekend. So congratulations, my friend. You made it to the end of the episode. Have a wonderful weekend. The fire is spreading. We'll see you next time as we continue to go down the road less traveled.
You've been listening to Choose FI Radio Podcast, where we help middle-class America build wealth one life hack at a time.